Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Hi, Dave. Quite a lot. It's been quite a busy month. And as you know, I often like to start this discussion close and in Earth orbit, and then move out through missions to through the solar system, then perhaps look at what's happening out in deeper space. So, yeah, let's follow that and let's keep local. And how much more local can you get than Guildford? So, Guildford is the home of my first two reports. Down at Guildford, we have, of course, the University of Surrey, where my Astronomical Society, Guildford AS, meets each month. But they've got a very large space centre there, the Surrey Space Centre, which was set up by Sir Martin Sweeting. And from there, there's been a spin-off, a corporate spin-off, called Surrey Satellite Technology Limited. And so these first two items are all about a couple of SSTL missions. And the first one, some of our listeners might have seen this, in fact, on television within the last couple of weeks. It's called Remove Debris, and you might remember me mentioning it a few months ago. So the idea is to investigate ways of getting down some of the flotsam that is in orbit. These are old defunct satellites, top stages of rockets that have taken the satellites into orbit, fairings that surround the satellite when they're deployed from the top stage, and fragments from where there have been collisions. There's even things like toolkits that have been dropped by astronauts when they're up on the International Space Station. So all of these things are travelling at a heck of a rate, and if they were to collide with a manned spacecraft, could be obviously fatal, or cost an awful lot of money were they to hit a communication satellite. And indeed, the International Space Station has to change its orbit periodically to avoid a known piece of debris that's approaching. But even small things like a fleck of paint travelling at 4 miles a second can do a lot of damage. So it's long known to be a problem, and SSTL have put up an experiment to see what might be amongst the best ways to get this stuff down safely. So the consortium was headed by the Surrey Space Centre, but SSTL was the main design authority and build authority, in fact. So this includes two CubeSats, Cube satellites, small satellites, relatively inexpensive. But these were taken up by our friends at SpaceX in one of their Dragon capsules on top of a Falcon 9 to the International Space Station in June. They were then removed by the astronauts on board the ISS, taken from the Dragon capsule and taken through the space station to a deployment bay where they've been sitting waiting. But they've just been deployed to test out the first experiment. There are four experiments, and the one that was just done was using a net. So we'll come back to that in just a mo. The others are to pierce a pretend satellite, a target, with a harpoon. Another experiment is using visual control, up, down, left and right, with a camera, just to see how well somebody that's going to fire something like a harpoon can track an object as a target. And then the last one is a drag sail to bring whatever has been captured down and so that it burns up in the atmosphere. So let's just have a quick look at what actually happened with this first of the experiments, and that was the idea of a net. First of all, one of the Cube satellites deployed a target. It threw out a small dummy satellite that then expanded itself. And was then tracked, and then a net, a metallic net. I'm not quite sure of the diameter. It was something of the order of a metre and a half to 2 metres big, the net, was flung out directly at this target satellite. And as you said, Dave, a little earlier, you thought it was a little bit like Spider-Man in space flinging his nets. I prefer to think of it as because I like history as well, as a retiarius, which was the gladiator who fought with a net.
Oh, the guy with the net.
That's the one.
Was the weapon he had as well? He had a long spear-type weapon,
yes,
didn't he?
That's indeed right. And another gladiator that he was often pitched against had a harpoon as well, which is quite good because, remember, harpoon is the next type of test they're going to make.
Capture device, yeah.
Anyway, the this target satellite started spinning, which they hadn't expected. Not quite sure why that happened, but the net still managed to catch it quite safely. Now, you might think, well, if they're putting more stuff up into space to do this, aren't they adding to the pollution problem in space? But of course, the impact of the net on the target satellite is enough to change its orbit, to slow it down. If you slow down something that's in orbit, that means the orbit will decay and it will gradually come lower and lower into the Earth's atmosphere and burn up nice and safely. That was a good first success. We've talked about Spider-Man and Retiarius. Another one to think of for one of their later experiments is going to be Mary Poppins. At least that's what it makes me think of, because the drag sail is to suddenly pop out something. It's like an umbrella, a big umbrella that unfolds. And the idea is to attach that to a satellite. Now, although we think of space as being a vacuum, it isn't. Even where the International Space Station is, we still have Earth's atmosphere, but extremely, extremely rarefied. But for something, like this umbrella, if you like, the drag sail, it'll be big enough to catch these remnants of the Earth's atmosphere, and that means it will slow down. There'll be friction, there'll be drag, so it slows down, the orbit decays and down into the atmosphere and safely burning up. So that will be the next one. So maybe we'll talk in a few months' time when they get round to doing that one about Mary Poppins in space as well. Anyway, let's stay with SSTL. Also within the last month, they've put up a couple of satellites together, but one of which was particularly interesting, and it was called a cheese grater, because that's just what it looks like. It's about, about 2 metres tall, a metre and a half wide or so. But just looking at this rectangular satellite, it does remind you of the, because of the openings in it, of a cheese grater. But these two satellites were launched together on an Indian rocket, the PSLV, which is Polar Satellite Launching Vehicle. And the satellite in question is called NovoSAR, S-A-R at the end there, NovoSAR 1. And this is a radar imaging technology demonstrator. SAR is synthetic aperture radar. Now, so this can see through clouds all the way down through the atmosphere to the surface of the Earth, including the sea. And one of the things it's going to be doing is mapping where ships are, and also able to detect oil spills, so it can link oil spill to ship and so on, which is, you know, something that people have been trying to do. Who is it that aren't really obeying the regulations, discharging oil, or it accidentally being discharged? So that's one of the things that SAR can do. Also, it'll be monitoring floods, crop growth. But the important thing about this one is that it's far, far lighter and much more compact than any previous similar missions. We have had synthetic aperture radar satellites in orbit before, but monstrous beasts that take a lot of throw weight to get them up into orbit. So, as I say, it's a technology demonstrator, hoping to demonstrate that SSTL has this capability to do this relatively cheaply. Each of these two satellites, the other one, by the way, was an optical imaging satellite for a company in Singapore. SSTL have already put three of those into orbit already. But each of those satellites weighs less than 1,000 pounds, and that is SSTL's forte: doing things cheaply and lightly. Which, you know, one is a concomitant of the other. Okay, let's move on. As we're mentioning the ISS a little while ago, as you know, the crews for the International Space Station are taken up at the moment in Russian Soyuz ferry vehicles, tried and tested hardware that's been going for decades and decades. Now, they discovered... The ground control discovered that there was a leak somewhere on the International Space Station. Had it been caused by one of these small particles pinging a hole in it somewhere? Maybe it was a natural thing, like a micrometeorite. The crew were instructed to try and trace the leak, you know, in which direction was the air moving to lose. It was only a small leak, but, you know, it could have been fatal. So they tracked it down to the Soyuz, Soyuz MS-09, which arrived at the space station with the last crew of three at the end of June. And they found the hole actually in the Soyuz that had brought the men up. And it was just 2 millimetres in diameter. Now, they wanted to investigate it before fixing it, so they used a microfiber camera poking through to see, in which direction had the thing, whatever caused the hole, come. And that's when they found a bit of a surprise. The hole wasn't produced from the outside in, it had been produced from the inside out. So, from the Soyuz outwards. So, sabotage? Well, hardly. An astronaut's not going to drill a hole in his own spacecraft, because that wouldn't do him and his mates a lot of good. So it was realised that this was a production problem. Something had gone wrong. Maybe a worker had not noticed it. Maybe they had and had plugged it, and under the air pressure, the plug had disappeared. Who knows? So they were then left to fix it. The first plug, temporary one, was they decided what to do, just to use gaffer tape, sort of stuff we use around the home. You'd have thought they'd have had a micrometeorite hole patch kit.
The American spaceships do, but the Russians, they have Russian blue tack, I thought.
Could well be. Surely it would be red tack.
Well, of course, yeah. Russian red tack.
Okay. But their final fix was using medical gauze and epoxy, which I'm sure is very inventive. I'm just a little surprised that they didn't have something tailor-made ready to use. So a human error in construction. The thing that worried me was, if it's in Soyuz, that Soyuz has got to return with crew in it. However, Soyuz is made up of effectively three compartments. There's the docking one, which gets dumped after it departs. There is the orbital module that the crew move around in whilst in transit from launch to the space station. And there's the return capsule that they actually land in. And fortunately, this hole is just in the orbital module, which will just burn up on the re-entry. You know, that gets detached from the descent module. So the crew aren't in danger. Presumably, that hole was there all, well, it must have been there all the way up, but it wouldn't have affected anything on the way up because it would be enclosed within the fairing on the top of the rocket. But it's because the Soyuz is permanently attached and open to the ISS in the event of a big emergency. They haven't got time to open doors. You know, they need to get in there fast. So the air from the ISS was leaking out through the Soyuz, hence the discovery of the problem. But a little bit worrying that something like that could happen. Now, I've mentioned SpaceX, yes, they've been continuing launching Falcons. That gets so continual, it's hardly worth reporting on anymore. But the SpaceX story that has caught the attention this month is that Elon Musk has now named the Japanese billionaire who has signed up for an undisclosed amount to fly around the moon on the SpaceX next rocket, which is the BFR, which might stand for Big Falcon Rocket. It hasn't been confirmed what the BFR initials do actually stand for. So the name of this gentleman is Yusaku Maezawa. Apologies if I haven't quite got that right. He's age 42, and he's the founder of a, I believe it's a fashion chain in Japan called Zozo. He is obviously exceedingly loaded. He was, in fact, one of the two, it turns out, that had signed up for the previous moon mission that SpaceX had announced, which was to fly a crewed Dragon spacecraft around the moon. I think it was going to go into orbit for a while, then come back. But the launch vehicle would have been the Falcon Heavy. Elon Musk decided to abandon that idea to put the efforts into concentrating on the development of the BFR. So that means it's been this Japanese chap's trip to the moon, which according to the initial timetables would have been 2019. Now it's on the BFR. That will be put back to 2023. Now at the news conference where Elon Musk was asked about this, you know, is this 2023 date real? Now, remember, of course, that Elon Musk is pretty famous for putting forward dates as that never come to pass. But, you know, what he's predicted does come to pass, but never by the date he first says. And he says these dates are aspirations rather than milestones. But I loved his response to the question about, is it 2023? Is this realistic? And he said, we are definitely not sure. Which I thought was quite good. We're definitely
like
not
aspirational
sure.
Dates.
Yes.
Here's one I'd like today.
Yeah. We've both worked in project management, Dave, so I don't think that would work quite on some of the projects that we've been involved in.
No, except for government ones, they're always even later than anybody expects.
Shh, they might be listening.
Well, I hope they are.
Okay. Anyway, this Japanese chap won't be going on his own. The BFR is, as I think you'll know from my previous descriptions of it, is a monster rocket. So he's going to take an entourage of 6 to 8 artists with him. Now, apparently, he's already put a lot of money into buying artwork, famous artwork, for his home and his buildings. So he wants different sorts of artists. He wants playwrights. He wants photographers. He wants literally artists and poets. In that group, musicians, so that they can all explain the trip through the media of their different sorts of art and make a difference to human art as a result, which is, you know, quite a nice ideal.
No, guy's a fruitcake, no question. But a bunch of artists.
He's a wealthy fruitcake.
Yeah, a very rich fruitcake. Well, he started a fashion chain, so I mean.
Yeah. One of the previous commanders of the International Space Station, American Scott, has said, hey, sounds like a good idea. My schedule is free to 2023 if there's a space. So, yeah, why not? Some of their artwork has shown some recent changes to the design features of the BFR. Not functional ones, but Elon Musk says that they're aesthetic design changes and they've been influenced by his liking of Tintin's rocket. Quite. I mean, if the design of your space rocket can be influenced by Tintin, then I think I would have second thoughts about going in. I'm sure that he's just joking, but what a line. Anyway,
we love Elon Musk.
This trip is just going to be a simple loop around the moon, not into orbit. So it's more or less a figure of eight, of course, off or orbit the Earth once, then off to the moon, round the moon, and back again to Earth in a figure of eight sort of trajectory. But well, I hope we're still going with this programme in 2023 if they meet it, and we shall report on it.
You're not an artist as well, are you, John?
An Get artist a of a no? sort, usually involving beer.
Oh, right. Right.
Let's stick with
that. That counts, yeah.
Okay.
We'll sponsor you, mate.
Let's stick with Japan, because their space agency is called JAXA, J-A-X-A. And I mentioned a couple of months ago about missions to asteroids, and one of them being the Japanese Hayabusa spacecraft. Now, that last month reached the asteroid, a very small asteroid called Ryugu, in the asteroid belt. And that has been generally stationed about 20 kilometres from the asteroid, but it has been periodically moving in quite close to get better and more detailed images of the surface so that it can determine where to land its rovers. And it has now just started that landing process. There's going to be 4 rovers deployed from this one vehicle. And at the moment, the first two, called Minerva, well, part of the Minerva phase of this experiment, they've been deployed. They're called Rovers 1A and Rover 1B. And they're tiny little things. They look like small biscuit tins, about 7 inches in diameter, but completely covered in solar cells, which they're using for power, to power the capacitors. So these drifted down from the from Hayabusa, not under thrust or anything like that. It just released them, and there is a tiny, tiny gravitational pull from Ryugu. It's only about, because Ryugu is only about 1 kilometer in diameter, its gravity is about 1/60,000th that of Earth, but still there. So these tiny little rovers just gently floated down and landed on the surface. Each of these is equipped with a camera and thermometer, And also metal spines sticking out of the bottom and the sides of the biscuit tins. And the power will cause these spines to thrust suddenly, to push. So it's hopping. They're hopping across the surface. And they'll float up to, I think it was something like 15 metres each hop will take them above the surface, take pictures, and as they're floating there, so the asteroid is rotating underneath them, when they come down, they'll be landing in a different place. So they have now started to send photographs back of the surface of the asteroid. So this is absolutely splendid. A larger lander is going to go down, which is a rover. I'm not sure of its roving mechanism or if it is just a lander, but that's one that's going to be, that has been built, I think, by both Germany and France, I think, are the two countries involved in that. But there's another one that Hayabusa has to deploy, a Japanese one, that's going to, at the end of the mission, blast a hole in the surface of the asteroid, Ryugu. Ryugu's been there for billions of years, so it will have collected a coating of dust. It'll have been irradiated by the solar wind, interstellar wind as well. And so rather than collect material from that surface, which isn't less known to us, you want to get the pristine contents of the interior, stuff that has never seen the sun, never been exposed. So they're sending an explosive down to blast a hole. Then the Hayabusa mothercraft is going to descend into that crater, sniff, collect some of the dust that's floating around, the debris, collect that and return to Earth. So that's one heck of a mission, and the Japanese are to be absolutely congratulated on that one.
That is really complex.
It is. Yeah, all of that.
And bring the material back to Earth again.
Absolutely, yeah. Don't forget, there is another return mission that is some way behind this in terms of the timescale, and that is OSIRIS-REx, a NASA mission, which is going to a much larger asteroid than Ryugu. But that, too, is a return mission. So we're going to be learning an awful lot about the formation of the solar system from these missions, because that's all the asteroids are. You know, builder's rubble left over from when the solar system was put together. And one last little thing about Japan. I've mentioned their space agency, JAXA. You know, that works in partnership with NASA and the Russian Roscosmos on the space station, as does the European Space Agency. Japan has just launched yet another of its cargo resupply vessels. We often on this program talk about how SpaceX have sent up a Dragon resupply vessel, or Roscosmos has sent up a Progress one. We did have a series of European ones that went up, very large vehicles. That series has now finished. But Japan has also been sending them, and I suppose been remiss, haven't mentioned those in the past, but this is either the sixth or seventh, forgive me, I can't quite remember which, in their series. And the Japanese ferry craft resupply vessels are much bigger than Dragon, or bigger than the Cygnus spacecraft, or indeed Progress, about the same size as the European ones were. They're designed to burn up in the atmosphere, so they just, having deployed all of their new experiments, food, recyclables, stuff like that, they collect all of the rubbish and put it into effectively this rubbish bin and send it down to burn up safely in the atmosphere. But this one is also taking up a lander so that experiments can be sent back to Earth from this small, I think about 2 metre big lander that is contained within the the ferry craft. So that will be taken out, stored in the space station until the guys want to send the results of some experiment back, and then this will land safely on Earth. So it's the first time the Japanese have done that. Okay, let's move on to, while we're talking about landing on asteroids and so on, well, we used to have an asteroid called Ceres. It was known as the biggest asteroid. But when Pluto got reclassified as a planet, from a planet down to a dwarf planet, Ceres 2 was reclassified up from being an asteroid to being a dwarf planet. So Ceres is where NASA's Dawn spacecraft is ending its life. You might remember that we've seen some tremendous photographs from the surface of Ceres taken by Dawn in close orbit around it, showing salt deposits, really bright white salt deposits in the middle of a crater on the surface. And these are thought to be upwellings from the briny interior of Ceres, and salt has come out and settled on the surface. We'd never seen these bright white spots anywhere else before. So Ceres is, as I say, going to be the final resting place for the Dawn spacecraft. It's running out of the hydrazine fuel that it uses to manage its orientation, pointing its antenna back to Earth. So it's just about finishing now, so it'll be unable to communicate with Earth, and so it's going to remain inert, silent, but safe in orbit around Ceres. Now, you might remember that Cassini was deliberately crashed and to burn up into Saturn's atmosphere, in case it were to, at some point in the future, crash on something like Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, where it's thought that life could well be possible. Ceres is thought, no chance of life there. So no need to worry about it crashing on Ceres, but let's take the craft far enough away so it's got a good, safe orbit around it, and it'll remain there for decades, hundreds of years. So it's had a tremendous 11-year mission. It's done some tremendous funding, science, so much that it's managed to get funding to having the mission extended not just once, but twice. And that's pretty rare for space missions because there's so much competition for the available funding. First of all, it went off to the largest asteroid, which is called Vesta. And it was in orbit around Vesta in 2011 and 2012. Then it powered up and changed trajectory so that it could reach the dwarf planet Ceres, which it did in 2015. So a tremendous success on the part of NASA there. I'm not sure if I mentioned this last month, Dave. Forgive me if I did. But one of their other missions, of course, was New Horizon, which went past Pluto, dwarf planet Pluto. And that has received enough funding for it to continue its mission. And that was the New Horizon spacecraft. Its trajectory, once it got past Pluto, was known. So they've now been looking to see, is there another object out in that part of the solar system that it could pass? And so, if so, can we tweak its orbit a little bit, its trajectory, so that it passes a little bit closer? And they found one that delights in the name 2014 MU69. But they've renamed it Ultima Thule. Thule is a place that old map makers used to put on for here be dragons, unknown lands, and so on. So this part of the solar system is called the Kuiper Belt. Again, it's icy chunks left over from the start of the solar system. So New Horizon has now spotted its target earlier than expected. They used the cameras on New Horizon to see, you know, can we see it? When are we going to start seeing it? And they found it earlier than they thought. It's at 100 million miles was when it was discovered. And it's approaching at a speed of a million miles a day. So the flyby is going to be on the 1st of January. So that would be fun to report on what we've learnt from Ultima Thule in the Kuiper Belt. Now then, let's move on. Not only do I like astronomy and space, but I like science fiction, Dave. And so this little item really amused me. Star Trek. I watch it avidly, and I'm sure that everybody will know the guy with the pointy ears who says, live long and prosper. He is, of course, Dave...
Mr. Spock.
Mr. Spock, quite right. And can you remember from which planet Mr. Spock originates?
The rubber planet, Vulcan.
Vulcan, indeed. Now, in the film where the Vulcans first betray their existence on Earth, it explains that they're because they're a relatively nearby species, not that far away from Earth, which is why it's the Vulcans that find that we are now spaceworthy. So in the stories, his home planet is described as being relatively nearby and also with a star that's not a single star like our sun, but a triple star. So one main primary star and two small stars further out that in fact orbit each other. Now astronomers, who, as I said, often like science fiction too, started to look through all the catalogues. Well, is there a star that's not too far away that fits that description? And they found one called 40 Eridani. And it's a fourth magnitude star. It can be seen by the naked eye. And it's a triple. And it's only 16 light years away, which is astronomically
just around the corner.
Just around the corner. Now, the interesting thing is astronomers, as I'm sure you know, are looking for exoplanets. And they've discovered an exoplanet in orbit around the primary star of 40 Eridani A, which is the primary star. And it's not one of the gas giants that we often find. It's a rocky planet. It's a larger-than-Earth planet, a super-Earth, which, again, the space Star Trek described Vulcan as being bigger than Earth. So, what's more, it's in the habitable zone of 40 Eridani A, you know, the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold, just right for water to exist. So this has been discovered by the Dharma Planet Survey, who are based in Arizona, on Mount Lemmon, and they use a whopping great 50-inch telescope. So that's fun. We can now say Spock's planet has been found, and what's more, it's one that anybody can go out into the night sky, armed with an appropriate star map, and find. You can see the star around which Mr. Spock's family are perhaps living at this moment. But it is the nearest super Earth planet, seriously. So it could one day be a target, perhaps, for one of our missions.
Yep, for Elon Musk, no problem.
Okay, let's press on. My next one. Talking about interplanetary visitors, you'll remember, Dave, we talked about Oumuamua, which was the very first interstellar visitor that we've had. Some kind of it was thought first to be an asteroid, or was it a comet? And it was realised that it hadn't originated within its our solar system, that it originated from elsewhere, another outside our solar system. And it was also wondered, could it possibly be a spacecraft like Rama in Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke? Now, scientists have, you know, we now definitely know it was most certainly extra solar, and it's on its way out of our solar system at the moment. Now, they did try to track back at the trajectory to see where might it have come from, which solar system might have expelled it. But they were unable to trace it back. Just using calculations based on this object being an inert chunk of rock. So they were unable to trace any origin at all. But some other scientists have now been revisiting the data all about the trajectory of the Oumuamua. And it's been found that it has, on its way out, it has deviated slightly from the expected course. And this is because of outgassing. As it passed the sun, it turns out it is perhaps a comet rather than an asteroid, or it has some cometary-like properties, because there was slight outgassing. Now, not outgassing to the extent that it could be seen, like a tail, which is what we get with ordinary comets, but that outgassing might have been sufficient to change its trajectory. It would have added a slight bit of thrust. So they've recalculated the incoming trajectory now using that data and can pin it down as coming from one of four very distant stars. There is one that is a little bit sun-like, HD 292249, and if Oumuamua did in fact come from there, if indeed it has got a solar system, we don't know that it has, then it would have left there about 3.8 million years ago. You know, these things, if they're thrown out of a solar system, don't get thrown out at a huge rate, just a little bit more than the planets around the orbit around the sun. And so it would have been a huge, long journey time. So if it had indeed have been an alien ship, it would have had to have been one with would allow life to evolve on it as part of its journey. However, they will be looking now at these four candidate original points for the Oumuamua, just to see if they do have planetary systems. Possibilities for future missions, future science, future studies. Indeed, the Gaia satellite, which is up there mapping stars in the Milky Way, should be looking at that part of space for its third release of data, which is scheduled for 2021. Three relatively short items for the listeners now, Dave. And two of them are at Mars. Now, Mars does have two satellites. These are called Phobos and Deimos, the dogs of war, given that Mars is, of course, meant to be the god of war. But these are tiny little bodies. And also quite dark as well. Phobos, the one under discussion, is probably one of the darkest bodies in the solar system. And that and its size have led many researchers to conclude that the moon is an asteroid that came too close didn't get burnt up or crash into the surface. Its trajectory just happened to be right to be captured. And it's a very low orbit that it whizzes round Mars in. We've had a very recent study that now says that Phobos is probably not an asteroid. It's a chip off the old block. In other words, it's the remnants of a collision of perhaps a much larger body with Mars itself. And as a result of that collision, material will have been thrown up, probably molten. Some of it will have been thrown up so high and so fast that it didn't fall back to the surface. Some of that might have escaped. Some of it perhaps coagulated into Phobos. And that's now the results of a study being carried out by some researchers. So it's only conjecture, but it's an interesting theory. But it's very much in keeping, of course, with the current theories about the moon's formation, that it's the remnants of Earth material that have been ejected when Earth crashed into a protoplanetary body, and that material eventually formed into the moon as the debris collected under its own gravity. Remember, the moon is still moving away from us, about the length of a fingernail's growth in a year. So that's Phobos. But still at Mars, you might remember me saying that they've had a dust storm fairly recently, and that sadly that had seen the slumber, won't call it a demise, of the Mars rover Opportunity, which has been doing sterling service for NASA on the surface of Mars. Because that one uses solar power, it had to shut down because the dust storm just blotted out the sun. There wouldn't have been enough to power its batteries, so it went into hibernation. Now, the dust storm has settled, but Opportunity is still silent. However, it has survived because it's been spotted. It's actually appeared in photographs taken from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has high-resolution cameras. So they can see that the spacecraft is there. It's shining silvery, so it seems to have been free now of the dust. Hopefully, it'll now start to recharge its batteries from sunlight, and will now get back into contact with Earth. But even if it doesn't, it's far exceeded expectations of its lifetime and the science that it's done. Now, we'll stay with dust storms, but just move out a little bit further. Mentioned Cassini. Of course, that has been in orbit around Saturn, but also did an awful lot of imaging of the moon Titan. Now, scientists have been going back through Cassini's data, and will probably be doing so for decades to come. There's so much raw data there to be further examined. And they believe, from tracking some of the infrared data that they've been looking at, that under the methane clouds of Titan, there are in fact dust storms on Titan too. Because the signature, the infrared signature of something moving below the surface is just the same as the infrared signature for dust storms on Mars and on Earth. So that's the conclusion. We can't see it, but we can infer from the evidence. So that's a third body now known that seems to have dust storms apart from the Earth and Mars. So that's it, Dave. A fair old bit that's happened and has caught my interest in the last month, and I hope our listeners have found it of interest too.
Thank you very much, John, for the fascinating update.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
What is your constellation this month then, John?
It's one that is quite easy to find. It looks like a W in the sky. or some people say perhaps it's McDonald's upside down rather than a W. but it is the constellation Cassiopeia, a bright set of stars, five main stars making this W shape, that are circumpolar, which means it never sets, so it's always visible at night. Sometimes it'll be above you, sometimes it'll be down low above the northern horizon, but it can always be found. And that's the home of several nice clusters, open clusters, that some of which are in the Messier catalogue that I've mentioned in the past. There's also some double stars there to be seen too. It's also quite a useful constellation for finding your way round. We all know how to find the pole star using the plough, but supposing there are clouds there over that part of the sky, well, you can find your way to the pole star using Cassiopeia, if that is clear, and use it to navigate to certain other objects in the night sky as well. So all of that's described in the video that can be found on the website.
Great. Thank you, John.
Stars Over Surrey, the monthly guide to the night sky.
Now, John, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
I always think October's a good month because we've still got some of the summer objects there in the early evening. Constellations like Hercules and Lyra and Cygnus, Aquila, and so on. Milky Way itself is right over the zenith, and Cassiopeia that I've just mentioned riding high in the sky, almost overhead. We've got other good constellations like Pegasus and Andromeda, where we can find some nice globular clusters in Pegasus, and of course the great nearest galaxy to us, the Andromeda galaxy, or Andromeda Nebula as it used to be called, M31. Other good constellations coming up, Perseus as well, not too far from Andromeda and Cassiopeia. Let's move on to thinking about the moon, how the moon is going to affect looking at the stars. It's going to be a full moon later on in the month. So for doing any deep sky work, then around the 8th is the best, when it's new moon. For looking at the moon itself, then in the morning, that will be about the 2nd, when it's at third quarter, a few days either side of that, or in the evening on the 16th, when it's at first quarter. So third quarter on the 2nd, new moon on the 8th, first quarter on the 16th, full moon on the 24th. But what's amongst the things that you'll be wanting to see, of course, are the planets. So working outwards from the sun, Mercury, not really visible this month. It is there, but it's so low on the horizon, southwest horizon, to be, to all intents and purpose, not really attainable. But the best chance is at the end of the month, so maybe just after sunset in the southwest, low at the end of the month. And I'll give you a pointer. Jupiter will be near it on a set date, which I'll come to shortly. Venus has been wonderful, of course, over the last few months, but that's now not visible, but will be becoming a morning star, a morning object, I should say, at the start of next month. Mars, absolutely wonderful, still a splendid object in the southern skies throughout the month. Pinkish red in colour and bright, magnitude -1.3. You can't miss it. There's nothing else as bright in that part of the sky, and nothing else with that sort of colour. Jupiter, low in the southwest at sunset, will be losing that by, well, it's still visible at the end of the month, but by next month it will be gone. It sets about 8 p.m. Saturn, still there as an early evening object, low in the south-southwest. Uranus, though, is really good at the moment, visible virtually the whole of the night. But do remember, it is a binocular or telescope object, and you will need a star map or some kind of app on your phone or on a laptop to help you to navigate your way to it. Even more the case for Neptune. That magnitude is plus 7.8. That's to be found in the constellation of Aquarius. Best around midnight to go out and look for both of those. But some events of interest. I always like to, because people can find the moon, so I like to tell you what objects that the moon is near, to help you to find them. So one of the messier objects that the moon happens to pass near is M44, Messier 44. That's the Beehive Cluster, or Praecipate, to give it its proper name. So on the 4th, in the early hours, the crescent moon will only be 3 degrees from M44. So that could make a nice picture, and binoculars will show the Beehive stars. It's called an open cluster, this type. We've got a meteor shower on the 8th. It's one that doesn't really attract much attention. That's the Draconids. Normally, its theoretical maximum is just 10 in an hour, and that's the theoretical maximum. The comet that is the origin of this dust cloud, that is the material that makes up these meteors, is nearby. So it could be that dust stream of particles is a little bit thicker. So you never know, you never can tell. We do suddenly get these little bursts of extreme meteor activity if you get a thicker part of the dust stream. So between midnight on the 8th and 1 o'clock in the morning on the 9th is best. Just get out there and let's see what happens. It could be better than the normal 10 per hour. On the 11th, the moon will be near Jupiter, low in the southwest. Jupiter, big and bright, can't be missed. On the 14th, the moon is going to have moved along a little bit through the sky, and it will now be near Saturn, about the same distance, 4.5 degrees or thereabouts, low in the south-southwest. So binoculars will reveal Saturn to be, not a point of light, but an oval sort of shape. That's probably all that binoculars will reveal. But a small telescope will show that oval is in fact the rings and the disk of the planet in the middle. Now, on the moon, on the 16th, we have, and it occurs every month, but you get an opportunity to see what we call the lunar X and the lunar V. So that's going to occur on the 16th. All it is, it's just an optical effect as craters that are next to each other catch the sunlight. So two crescents of craters form up the X, again, two walls of craters elsewhere on the moon make a V. So it's about a third of the way down from the top, as seen through a telescope, on what we call the terminator. The terminator is the line where the sun is rising. So it's the line between light and dark on the moon on the 16th. On the 18th, the moon will have moved across just a little bit and it will be close to Mars. So 3 degrees away from Mars in the south. Now, you can also find a bright star that you might not otherwise have found by looking near the moon on the 27th. Again, the moon will be waning by that time, and the star called Aldebaran, the brightest star in the constellation of Taurus, will be quite close to the moon then, just 4 degrees away. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you might be able to find Mercury if you can find Jupiter. That's on the 30th. So look low in the southwest, just after sunset, and Jupiter you should be able to find as a bright star, and look for a little spark, only 3 degrees away from Jupiter, low in the southwest, and that will be Mercury. Okay, now some local societies. Guildford Astronomical Society on the 4th of October at the University of Surrey have a talk by Dr. Mikako Matsura, and that is about the Herschel Space Observatory and ALMA. And how they explore deep into space. I've just realised, Dave, that on the slides on the website, that meeting is shown as being in the Griffiths Lecture Theatre. I think I've made a mistake there. I think it's just lecture, the usual lecture theatre, L, if my memory serves me right. So I will need to check that out. But that's the Thursday the 4th. Farnham Astronomical Society, meeting at Aldershot Cricket Club on the 9th, have Dr. David Bacon from the University of Portsmouth, and his talk is called Probing the Dark Universe. Perhaps here we're talking about dark matter and dark energy. I'm not sure on that one. Could just be something called dark nebula. We've also got... Dave, I'm going to have to halt there, sorry. I forgot. Croydon Astronomical Society have two talks this month. They meet at the Royal Russell School, Coombe Lane, Croydon. And on Friday the 5th of October at 7:45, they have Thermonuclear Fusion in Stars from Mark Smith, who I believe is one of their own members. But they have a guest, an excellent speaker I've heard several times, Greg Smy-Rumsby, who does quite a few of the talks at the Royal Observatory Greenwich and is one of their planetarium presenters. He will be there on Friday the 19th, again at 7:45, talking about life in the universe. Yule Astronomical Society also meet at school, Nonsuch High School for Girls in Cheam, and on Friday the 12th, 7:45, their talk is Schiaparelli, the Postmortem and What Comes Next. That's by Dr. David Evans, the University of Birmingham. Schiaparelli is the European Space Agency's attempts to land on Mars. If you may remember, it failed. It went in too fast. But it's a two-part mission. That lander didn't work, but there's a rover, which is part of the same mission, is yet to be launched. And on the sky at night, we've got one looking at Britain in space. It's called Space Britannia. And Magari Adarin-Pocock investigates microsatellites that are driving the UK's resurgent space industry. So I'm sure she'll be at SSTL for part of that. And the description goes on to say, as well as plans for a new rocket system and our first spaceport in the north of Scotland. And then we have Tim Peake. UK astronaut Tim Peake visits the Science Museum to discover Britain's past glories in space and where it all went wrong. Because at the Science Museum, as if you've been there, I'm sure you have, they've got a replica of our first and only satellite, Prospero, and the launcher, which was the Black Knight, if memory serves me right. And so no doubt he'll be using that as the backdrop. But the programme is on Sunday the 14th of October at BBC 4, 10 o'clock, with the usual repeat on the following Thursday, the 18th, BBC 4 again at 7:30. Did you know, Dave, that there have been, I think it's 12 nations that have launched satellites now? And that includes places like Iran, North Korea, Israel, and so on. They count 12 if you separate out Russia and Ukraine from the Soviet Union and count those as three. You might want to count them as one. And Britain, of course, was, I think, the sixth after the Soviet Union, America, France, China, Japan, and then us. And we're the only country out of those 12 to have given up the capability. Isn't that sad? So no doubt that's what Tim Peake will be talking about.
Well, thank you, John, for the fascinating insights. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will have more items that we couldn't fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday, the 26th of October.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.